It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we deal with control issues, not between all of us, but between plants and us. Our guest is journalist and gardener Michael Pollan. He thinks plants cash in on our basic desires and manipulate us to work for them. His book is called The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. The Stearns have found great old-time Czech food in Omaha. Anya von Bremsen from Travel and Leisure magazine reports on Aleppo, one of the ancient power centers of the Middle East. Then it's The Secrets of Sorrel with Chef Jerry Traunfeld. And gourmet magazine editor Ruth Reichel joins us with a tale of indulgence and seduction. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure. A practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Today, let's talk about making pie. Most of us don't make pie very much, but when fruit is in its prime or when you're just dying for a good piece of pie, you should try one. Pies aren't as intimidating as they may seem. Pies are logical once you know the basics. This is part one of making pie. Today I've got tips for great pie crust. In another Kitchen Chronicle, we'll talk about pairing crusts with fillings and actually baking the pie. Now, even if you miss the next installment, I think you'll be able to bake pie once we get rid of pie crust intimidation. Even experienced cooks get nervous with it. I really believe once you understand the concepts of pie crust, you'll conquer it. Any recipe will be easier. Remember, we are not talking actual recipes here. Instead, we have a formula and some concepts. But this is where the power lies. Knowing how and why in cooking means that you're home free. Now for some pie crust basics. First, you can do pie dough ahead. Pie doughs keep in the fridge about 2 days or so, and they freeze well up to 3 months. Now, most pie crusts follow the same three steps. Number one, you mix the dry ingredients, flour, salt, maybe some sugar. Number two, you cut in some kind of cold fat, meaning that you break up the fat in the flour so that it's coated with the flour. You can do this by rubbing the flour and fat together between your fingers or using a food processor. Step three. Then you add cold liquid. You sprinkle it over the mixture to moisten everything, then toss it with a fork. Now, what's important to know is don't beat the dough. It's going to get tough. It should end up looking like a lot of rough clumps. You gather that into a ball, and you've got pie crust. Now let's start breaking down the process. Here is where you're controlling the crust rather than the crust intimidating you. Pie crusts have formulas. There's so much flour to so much fat to so much liquid, and that produces a certain kind of crust. Professional bakers work by weight. We can do it too. If you measure your flour by dipping a measuring cup into the bag of flour and leveling it off with a flat edge of a knife, don't tamp it or tap it down, you'll have 5 ounces of flour, more or less. For an easy-to-handle crust that tastes good and is big enough for an 8-inch two-crusted pie, the formula is 10 to 6 and 6. You want 10 ounces of flour, that's 2 cups, a half teaspoon of salt, that's just for flavoring, 6 ounces of ice-cold unsalted butter, that's 1.5 sticks, and then 6 tablespoons of cold liquid to finish the dough. If you add sugar, anywhere from 2 to 6 tablespoons, the crust is going to be stickier, but it bakes crisper and obviously tastes sweet. Then you can flavor the crust. Add cinnamon, add ground nuts, citrus zest, and you could use apple cider or orange juice as the liquid. Now, here is the secret to not making hockey puck doughs. Whenever you handle pie dough, that means mix it or roll it out, give it a 30-minute rest in the fridge. That's all there is to it. That way you'll always have tender pie. What happens is that every time you mix the dough, the protein in the flour, which is called gluten, gets activated. Now, when you stretch out those gluten strands, they're like rubber bands. they make it tough. This is great when you're making bread, but it's lousy when you're making pie. So every time you mix, chill it, it relaxes, and everybody's happy. So the next time you want to make pie, just remember 10, 6, and 6. 10 ounces of flour, 6 ounces of butter, and 6 tablespoons of cold liquid. I have one last trick for you, though. You can decide whether you have a cookie-like dough or you have a flaky dough. And it's just in how you mix the fat with the dry ingredients. If you leave the fat in big chunks, you'll have a flaky dough. If you mix it in quickly and you get little pieces, you'll have a cookie dough. So, try making pie crust and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, offering Cascade stoneware made by Anchor Hocking. This Portuguese stoneware, designed to be rugged, features an unglazed bottom for even cooking and can be used in the microwave, oven, or on the table. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Well, today we have a new take on gardening and agriculture. It's all about who's in control. Our guest, journalist and gardener Michael Pollan, claims we're deluding ourselves if we think we manipulate plants. It's the plant that's doing the manipulating. His book is The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. Anya von Bremsen of Travel and Leisure magazine brings us some exotica, one of the ancient food centers of the Middle East, Aleppo, in Syria. Chef Jerry Traunfeld has his way with the herb sorrel. Then it's a tale of a young food writer's initiation into the dazzling world of the restaurant critic from the memoirs of Gourmet Magazine's editor Ruth Reichel. And as we do every week in the second half of the show, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are here and ready to go. Now, they write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Michael and I were recently in Omaha, Nebraska. We happened to time it exactly perfectly because a tornado came through the minute we were there. But fortunately, the town stayed intact for long enough for us to eat at the Bohemian Cafe on South 13th Street in Omaha. Let me just read you a little poem on the paper placemat that is put on your table when you sit down. Dumplings and kraut today at Bohemian Cafe. Draft beer that's sparkling. Plenty of parking. See you at lunch, okay? I do kind of like parking and sparkling, right?
Oh, don't be fussy, Jen.
I know. I'm such a snob.
What kind of food is this? This sounds great.
Well, the marquee in front of the Bohemian Cafe says, check us out. So it's C-Z-E-C-H, us out. It's Czech food.
But it's not all Czech food. I mean, it's sort of middle European food. You can get wonderful a Czech goulash, which is a kind of vivid red, smoky pork stew. That's one of the best goulashes I've had anywhere.
It was incredible, served with bread dumplings. Oh
this sounds so good. You're getting
cabbage.
Into very serious eating here.
Serious.
You have to bring a big appetite to this place because one of the other great dishes, and to tell you the truth, I don't often like this dish, but here it's wonderful, is sauerbraten because it's a stack of just the tenderest slices of kind of pot roast, just marinated to death beef. I mean, they just pull apart easily with a fork. And it's not that kind of cloying sweet sauerbraten. It's mm-hmm. a real oomph to it.
How come a Czech place in Nebraska?
Omaha?
Yeah. Is there a large Czech population?
There is a large Czech population in Omaha, Nebraska. Certainly enough to keep this restaurant going since 1924. It's been there forever. 7 decades.
But, you know, the thing is, Lynn, when you travel around the Great Plains, one of the great joys of road fooding around there is big and little towns where the communities have these kind of really long-standing ethnic populations, primarily from Middle and Eastern Europe. They are wonderful kind of German, Czech, Polish communities. Many of which have restaurants to match. It's a wonderful place to kind of discover ethnic food where you wouldn't expect it.
And it's kind of wonderfully corny, if I can say that in a not demeaning way. I mean, the waitresses here who are all real veteran waitresses wear bright red dirndl skirts, and you sit on benches in the dining room that look like they came out of a 1956 Bel Air. I mean, they're kind of plush aqua seats, you know, bench seats that look like they came from an old car. I mean, this is the kind of wonderful old place that was started in the 20s, obviously revamped in the 1950s, and stuck in a time warp. But the food is just terrific. I mean, there are no shortcuts taken here.
Is it a big place?
It's huge. It's huge. It's a banquet hall. There are room after room after room in this place. It's a place to have a party.
Ah, okay.
And if you're having a party, make sure you order ahead of time the duck, because the roast duck was one of, except for the sauerbraten, one of the best things I've ever had, with crisp skin. But this is not modern, you know, sort of undercooked duck, you know, rare duck breast. I mean, this was classic Middle European mom made it duck. I mean, just absolutely terrific.
It is. And the one thing that they have at the Bohemian Cafe that you'll find, I dare say, nowhere else is a huge collection of Jim Beam commemorative bottles, including one called the Bohemian Girl Jim Beam Commemorative, styled on the Bohemian Girl of the Bohemian Cafe. They were the inspiration for it.
Uh-huh. So we have great food, and then we have a commemoration.
Right. So you can buy it on eBay after you're through.
Pretty soon we're going to be able to buy you two on eBay. Thanks.
You're welcome, Lynn. Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Square Meals, America's Favorite Comfort Food Cookbook. You can hear them here every week, but you can get their road food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Some people have the best jobs. Anya von Bremsen is a concert pianist turned food writer who reports on the world's dining scenes for Travel and Leisure magazine. Her latest adventure has been in the Middle East. Anya, welcome back.
Thanks, Lynn.
So where were you?
Well, I was in Beirut for about 10 days, which was quite an adventure. And then from there, I moved on to Syria. And that was a real eye-opener. I think it's my new favorite country.
Well, where in Syria were you?
I started off in Damascus. Then we went to Palmyra, which is this great archaeological site. And then we ended up in Aleppo in northern Syria, which is really one of the most fascinating cities, not just in the Middle East, but in the whole world.
Now, I've heard that Aleppo was one of the great cultural and gastronomic centers historically in the Middle East. Is that true?
Well, of course it was true, because it's a very important trading point. And the souk, the market there, has essentially been untouched since the 12th century. It's about 20 miles of arcades. So
20 miles?
That's what they say. Yes. Yeah, some, there are some claims. I don't think anyone has measured it, but somewhere around there. And it's essentially a city within a city, you know, with its own subdivisions, The only transport is donkeys. They started allowing motorcycles, which everyone is complaining is ruining the scene. But essentially, everything is transported by donkey. And the architecture is absolutely beautiful. It has its own mosques. It's own hammam. It really is self-contained sort of thing. And it's still a huge center of trade in the region.
What is the food like?
The food at the souk or the food in Aleppo?
Well, the food in both places. But let's start with the souk. Do you eat in the souk? Are there restaurants and that kind of thing?
Well, there's sort of stalls. You know, there's a lot. Of course, you know, no trading goes on without tea. So there are tea shops all over, and you know, little boys, you know, scurrying back and forth, you know, bringing tea. And there are juice stalls. You know, there are stalls selling fresh pomegranate juice. And then there's a little sort of alleyway lined with restaurants. But the food is very simple. It's what the traders want to eat. For instance, it's hugely popular with the Bedouins. I mean, most of the souks trade, you know, caters to Bedouins who come from the desert. And, you know, they make a lot of money, some of them, and they stash it up. And then they come out to the souks, all dressed in their best gold, all, you know, with painted faces. So there are a lot of stalls that do, for instance, hummus, which is a quintessential Bedouin meal. It's not just a dip. But
the ground chickpeas and
the ground chickpea dip that you serve warm with sort of a moat of olive oil around it, and you just scoop it up with bread. So there are these cafes, you know, filled with Bedouin traders, you know, having their hummus. You know, and they just do simple bean things. There are places that do little pizza, you know, lahmacun, that sort of thing. But it's not really a restaurant scene.
Well, what you're describing sounds like it's stepping right out of the Arabian Nights. But what about the restaurant scene then in Aleppo?
Aleppo in itself is a very cosmopolitan city. It's there's a huge Christian population, there's a huge Armenian population, and free trade was always encouraged there. So what they're doing there in the old Christian quarter, they are reviving old Armenian houses that have, you know, beautiful courtyards with beautiful details, and they're turning them into restaurants and boutique hotels. And that's where they're reviving the traditional home cooking of Aleppo.
What kinds of things is there?
Well, one thing that is a mainstay of local cuisine, well, two things. One is kibbeh, which is raw ground lamb, sometimes mixed with bulgur, sometimes not. And a restaurant sometimes would serve up to 15 kinds of different kibbeh, you know, with different spices in different shape. And the other thing is a kebab. And the kebab is not the sort of chunks of meat as we know it. The kebabs there are more like köfte. The ground meat, usually lamb, on skewers, and there are myriad varieties. The most traditional kebab of Aleppo is the sour cherry kebab.
Ooh.
And it's cooked off the skewers, this little meatballs, in this dark, kind of sweet, sour, molassesy sauce that's just absolutely extraordinary. And then they do kebabs with pistachios, kebab, a stick of kebab baked in an eggplant. It's just endless.
This sounds fabulous.
Fabulous. And the meze are extremely nice. You know, little pickles, baba ganoush, your hummus, your stuffed grape wine leaves. And usually the repertoire doesn't vary throughout Syria. But in Aleppo, you get things that are really different and unique, and the flavorings are very subtle. Because it's right close to Turkey. There's a big Armenian influence, which means they're using a lot of walnuts. So it's this crossroads cuisine.
Anya, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen writes for Travel and Leisure magazine and is author of the award-winning book on Russian food, Pleas to the Table. Well, coming up, how we are manipulated by plants, Ruth Reichel's tale of initiation into the world of food critics, and we're opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Every spring, there's this urge to grow something. I mean, even if it's in a flower pot, you get stirrings about planting a seed and making a plant. And that's the idea. We control the plant. At least we think we control the plant. Journalist Michael Pollan writes for The New York Times and Harper's Magazine. And Michael is a gardener with an interesting take on botany. He wonders whether the plants are actually controlling us. His new book is The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. Michael, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Michael, tell me the premise behind this book.
Well, the premise is very simple, and it occurred to me while I was in the garden, working alongside a bumblebee, and thought to myself, as I'm wont to, that how am I existentially any different than that bumblebee? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that we had more in common than we like to think.
In what sense? Well,
we're both working for the plants. And we've both been fooled by the plants into thinking we're getting the better end of the deal. You know, the bumblebee breaks into the flower and thinks he's making off with the nectar. But without him knowing that, he has picked up the pollen of the flower on mm-hmm. his thighs, and he's moving it around the garden. So the flower has evolved to trick the bee into spreading its genes around the world. And that is exactly what domesticated plants have done to us. They have evolved in the direction of our desires, giving us great things to eat, wonderful smells, flowers of great beauty, and even drugs. And in exchange for that, we have done things like spread their genes around the world, written whole books about them, devoted to their welfare. So as I see it, I am working in the garden for the plants, and even as a writer, perhaps, as much as they're working for me. And that really is the definition of coevolution. Huh. You know, when Darwin talked about coevolution, it's two species entering into a mutually beneficial relationship, which is exactly what happens between me and the potato or me and the apple. And we don't think of this as part of evolution, but of course it is.
Well, now in the book, you focus on four plants. Why do you do that?
I chose four plants because they each spoke to a different important human desire. So I talked about the apple and sweetness. I talked about the tulip and beauty. I talked about the marijuana and intoxication. And I talk about the potato and control. This book is as much about our desires as it is about the plants. I'm very interested, you know, after a plant has co-evolved with us for 10,000 years, as most of these have, mm-hmm. they have sort of taken up into their very identity our values, what we like, our desire for sweetness, our ideas of beauty. You know, you look at a tulip of a certain kind, and you can infer an idea of what we think is beautiful. In the same way, you can look at a wildflower and think, ah, that's what bees like. They like symmetry. They like they like the color red. So at this point, you can read a lot about our culture and who we are and what makes us tick in these plants. And that's one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is use the plants as a mirror to understand ourselves.
And the potato is a great example of that, because I'm thinking the potato began in the Andes.
In the Andes, yeah. It was domesticated by the precursors of the Incas about 8,000 years ago. And it started out as a very unpromising little tuber. It was extremely bitter, actually a little bit poisonous. You know how potatoes, when they turn green, you're not supposed to eat them. That's the solanine. It's a chemical, an alkaloid that develops there. And they used to have too much of that to eat. Domestication in that case was a process of finding the mutation that produced a sweet potato that didn't have a lot of solanine in it. So we selected over the years for potatoes that were sweeter, for potatoes that were more nourishing, that were larger, that were blue, that were yellow, that were red. and we transformed the potato. But of course, in the process, the potato transformed us.
Now, you specifically talk about in the book a single kind of potato that you decided to plant.
Yeah, I decided there was a lot of controversy developing around genetic modification of food, especially in Europe. I decided, wouldn't it be interesting to grow a genetically modified crop in my garden? So I got a hold of some new leaf potatoes that Monsanto had developed. And this is a potato that actually creates its own pesticide. A gene for bacteria has been spliced in so that every cell in that plant is releasing a BT toxin, it's called. It's a bacterial toxin.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when the Colorado potato beetle comes along and takes a bite, it's poisoned and dies. Now, this pesticide, this BT, is a naturally occurring toxin in the soil, and it's used commonly by organic farmers. So it is probably one of the least toxic pesticides we have. On the other hand, eating it is a whole other question. Do you want to eat pesticide? And I grew this to explore that and to decide, well, did I want to eat this or not, and did it work? And I discovered that it works. I watched Colorado potato beetles take a bite of the leaves of these plants and keel over and die.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a little bit of satisfaction out of that. But then when I harvested them, I was faced with this decision. Is this something I want to eat? And I kind of equivocated for a long time. I got this beautiful harvest of potatoes. I kept them in a bag on my porch. As I learned more and more about them, and I learned about some of the environmental risks and some very hypothetical health risks. So far, there have been no health problems found with these potatoes. And although I should say, on the other hand, nobody's looked very hard to find these problems. The potatoes are genetically modified food is very lightly regulated. It's essentially voluntary. And so I kept putting it off. I had more interesting potatoes. I was growing fingerlings, and so the bag sat on my porch. And then finally I got this call that there was going to be a town picnic at the lake in the town where I live. And I said, perfect, I will make a potato salad. But even before I could get the water on to boil, I had second thoughts, and that was this. I mean, how could I possibly serve genetically modified potatoes to my neighbors without telling them? And in a way, that's really the dilemma we face as a culture. You know, we're eating all this food. It's already in the food chain. But, of course, we're not told. But I felt morally obliged to say something about it. And as soon as I realized I was going to have to tell people, well, I knew perfectly well that if there was any other potato salad that day, mine would go uneaten. I mean, because given the choice, what are you going to do? I mean, what's in your self-interest? The risk may be very small, but there's absolutely no benefit for the eater. So I didn't make my potato salad. And my potatoes stayed on the porch.
Well, how does this tie into your theory about the plants essentially controlling us?
Well, I think genetic modification changes in a profound way the whole many millennium old history of our relationship to plants. If you look at it carefully and go watch how they do it, which I did, I went to the Monsanto labs, this is a very different way of changing nature. Normally, in a coevolutionary relationship, such as we have with the plants propose, through mutations and natural variation, all the different possibilities. There's a universe of things a potato can become. It can become blue, it can become pink, it can be starchy, it can be sweet. But essentially, the potato is doing all the proposing. As Darwin says in Origin of Species, man chooses from the variation presented by the plants, but he does not create the variation. Now we do. Nature could evolve for a trillion years, and it will never think to put a flounder gene inside a tomato in the way that the bioengineers have done. So this is fundamentally a new thing. The plants have lost their sort of veto on what they're willing to become, and now can become just about anything. Now, that may be a good thing or a bad thing. It's certainly a nervous-making thing because it's very novel. And whenever we do something new in nature, I think we have to be extremely cautious about it because the food chain is long and complicated. And if you mess with it at one end, you know, you really must pay attention to the effects at the other end. And we simply don't know what those are yet.
Well, in the meantime, I'm going to be looking at the bumblebee differently. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Well, Michael Pollan is contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World. I couldn't resist this. I've got a potato salad recipe for you. Now, you can make it with any kind of potato you want. And it has an interesting twist. It has roasted asparagus in it. Now, these are pretty easy to do, by the way. Okay. You can get my roasted asparagus potato salad by going to our website at splendidtable.org. So you've been fooling around with fresh herbs, maybe sprinkling some over the takeout salad or a pizza. Well, I've got somebody you should meet. Chef Jerry Traunfeld has the herb gift. Jerry cooks at the famous Herb Farm restaurant outside Seattle. He's written the Herb Farm cookbook, and he joins us on a regular basis. Jerry, welcome.
It's great to be with you again, Lynn.
I've got a challenge for you.
Okay.
There's one herb that I have just never been crazy about, and I'd like you to sell me on it, because if anybody can do it, you can.
Okay.
It's sorrel.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, sorrel is a very particular herb. It's not like other herbs that when you brush against them or rub them, it's not aromatic. It's not like sage or rosemary that has this great appeal. Sorrel is all about the flavor when you bite into it because it's sour. It has this almost lemony flavor because it's full of oxalic acid. And sorrel, you know, it's a spring herb, so it's like one of the first things to pop up in the garden. And it's the garden sorrel that we usually cook with gets to be about 8 inches tall, and it looks kind of like spinach. It has a deep green leaf, but it's a very thin leaf, and they're long, almost like a very long arrowhead shape. It adds this great lemony flavor, and when you taste it on its own, it's not so appealing, but when you make a sauce with it and then eat that with fish, with a beautiful piece of poached salmon, it's amazing.
Oh,
it has
okay.
just this amazing affinity for seafood and for some other foods like chicken and greens.
So I don't get much aroma from rubbing the sorrel. That may be one of my problems with it. But it's a matter, you have to cook it. You can't use it raw.
Well, you can put it in salads. There's nothing wrong with that, tearing up the leaves, and it adds a little lemony accent. But I like to cook it, and one of my favorite things to do is to make a sauce with it. And it has particular qualities when you cook with it. One is that it turns there's no getting around it. It turns the most hideous green color you could ever imagine. But it also breaks down very fast. It almost turns into a puree all by itself. But I like to do is to sauté a few shallots, then add a lot of chopped sorrel. And you can just take out the center vein first and then just coarsely chop it. Add it to the pan, and in about a minute, it'll just turn into this green sort of puree. And if you like, you can add a little bit of heavy cream to it. But just try that with fish. And another thing it's great with is eggs. If you use that sauce as a filling for an omelet,
ooh,
again, it has just this
okay.
great combination of flavors with the eggs. And I also use it on what I call a smoked salmon benedict, where I'll put a poached egg on top of English muffins or crumpets, add a little smoked salmon, and then top it with this sorrel sauce. And it's just a great variation of eggs benedict.
You know, I think I'll reconsider. Jerry, thanks.
I hope you do, Lynn. Thank you.
Chef Jerry Traunfeld is author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. Well, he left us with this recipe, the smoked salmon benedict with sorrel sauce, and you can get it by going to our website, splendidtable.org. Ruth Reichel is editor of Gourmet Magazine. Her new memoir, Comfort Me with Apples, is the story of her apprenticeship as food writer and restaurant critic. You know, everybody starts somewhere. Ruth has a tale of excess, celebrity, and seduction in Los Angeles.
The rent-a-wreck I picked up at LAX was in better shape than my Volvo. The horn worked, the turn signals operated automatically, and the radio got both AM and FM. I hit a blues station and sang along with Willie Dixon as I turned onto the Santa Monica freeway. The magazine was putting me up at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and I loved the cool, opulent privacy of my room. L.A., I thought, as I drove to meet the food editor for dinner, might not be so bad. The feeling lasted until I arrived at Ma Maison and saw the Jaguars, Rolls Royces, and Mercedes parked in front. How could I possibly hand my rent-a-wreck to the valet? I couldn't. I drove right past the restaurant and parked on the street. By the time I got to ma maison, I was excruciatingly aware that my dress was hemmed with scotch tape and my shoes in need of a shine. But the restaurant's covered patio, with its astroturf and white lawn furniture, restored my confidence. Ma maison was oddly tacky. When the restaurant's owner looked me up and down in the appraising manner of aging Frenchmen who think women are good for only one thing, I straightened my back and stuck out my chin. Patrick Terrail led me through the patio to the dim interior of the restaurant. He escorted me to a table, but it was so dark that all I could see was the outline of the food editor seated across from a massive man, a small mountain planted at the far side. As we got closer, I thought he looked vaguely familiar, but I couldn't remember his name. "Coleman," said Patrick, in a sort of lewd Rod Stewart rasp. "Your guest is here." The food editor leapt from his seat and introduced me to the mountain. It was Orson Welles. The actor surveyed me with intelligent eyes that seemed trapped in the flesh of his face. I shook the great man's hand, and then Coleman and I followed Patrick out of the darkness to the twilight of the patio. Coleman, I realized, reminded me of the natty young Welles of Citizen Kane, the bon vivant who was thrown out of every elite American college. He held my chair as I sat down. A few hours earlier, I would have found this hopelessly hokey. We began with 66 Krug and a pot of caviar. When I put some on my tongue, it was not salty the way other caviar was, but seductively fruity with a taste that went on and on. Then I took a sip of champagne, and instead of washing the taste down, it brought it back to life, sharper now, more intense. I closed my eyes. I was somewhere else when a voice just above my head said, "Coleman." I jumped and opened my eyes. A man in a tall white toque was standing at the table. He had a round face and a snub nose he kept rubbing with his finger like a little boy. "Coleman," he repeated in a thick Austrian accent, "shall I make a menu for you? I have a few dishes I would like you to try." So this is how real restaurant critics live, I thought. Movie stars, caviar, special menus. "Shall we let Wolfgang impress us?" Coleman asked, cocking his head to one side. The chef turned and looked at me imploringly, as if my opinion were the only thing in the world that mattered. "I've been doing something with oysters that I think you will like," he murmured. Unsure of what Coleman wanted, ever so slightly, I nodded my head. "Good," said the chef. "I go cook now." As he walked away, Coleman said, "Wolfgang Puck is the most talented young chef in Los Angeles. I think he's going to be important. I hope you like his food." There were baked oysters wrapped in lettuce, sprinkled with caviar and bathed in beurre blanc. There was terrine de foie gras with warm toast. We drank Corton Charlemagne and talked about New York and Paris and Rome. It all felt unreal, as if our dialogue had been lifted from one of those 1930s movies where mink coats go flying out of windows and there are only happy endings. He was Cary Grant, I was Katharine Hepburn. Coleman didn't like sweets, so I ate his dacquoise and then I ate mine. We had cognac. He smoked a cigar. Suddenly, it was 5 hours later, and the movie stars were all going home. By the time we were the only people in the restaurant, Patrick Terrail and Wolfgang Puck were sitting with us. We drank more cognac and talked about food. I felt beautiful and charming. I felt a million miles from Berkeley. Then Coleman waved his hand and said, "Just put it on my account." I had never known anyone with a house account in a fancy restaurant before. Coleman pulled out my chair, put his arm around me, and asked where my car was. "Perfect," he said, when I told him I had parked on the street. "We'll just come back for your car in the morning." He held the door for me. "Yes," I said, walking through. The valet opened the door. I climbed in.
Ruth Reichel is editor of Gourmet Magazine and author of Comfort Me with Apples. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's today's trivia question. What's the key link between singer Bob Marley and the Spice, not the group, Allspice? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour, so you can give us a ring. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what's the key link between singer Bob Marley and the edible allspice? Well, it's Jamaica. They were both raised there. And maybe there's another link. They were both misunderstood early in their careers and had to struggle for recognition. Now, at first, people thought allspice was pepper, which would have made it like pure gold. You see, those early explorers who came to the West Indies from Europe were hunting for spices. That was where the money was. And no spice was more valuable than pepper, as in black pepper. A shipload of black peppercorns could make you as rich as Bill Gates. So when they saw that allspice on the tree looks a lot like peppercorns, they thought they'd hit the jackpot. When they realized that they didn't have pepper, but instead this spice that tasted like cloves and cinnamon with a little black pepper in it, they figured it wasn't a total loss. To market allspice back in Europe, those clever importers gave it spin. They named it Jamaica pepper. And in England, it was dubbed allspice. But the whole idea was they connected it to the peppercorn. And they sold it, and they made a lot of money on it. Now, you always find allspice in the hotter-than-Hades Jamaica jerk chicken. Now, you can do a simpler marinade by just blending ground allspice with some hot chilies, garlic, and lime juice. Rub that into chicken or meat and then cook it. It's out of this world. The lines are now officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Frank on the line. So, Frank, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have three or four trees heavily laden with loquats, and I don't really know what to do with them except eat them raw.
All right, you're going to have to explain to everybody what a loquat is.
Well, it's sometimes called a Japanese plum, and it's it's between a plum and an apricot.
Yeah, and it's oval.
Fruit.
Yeah, it's beautiful color, this golden,
Yes. Almost
apricot yellow.
But in the past, I've made chutney with it, and when it cooks up, it turns almost a liverish brown.
Yeah, I don't think you want to do that.
No, I don't.
I have to tell you, this is the fruit that almost got me killed.
Oh, my goodness.
No, let me tell you what happened. The first time I ran into it straight from the trees was in southern Italy. And I was driving, and I had tasted it in someone's house. And I personally, I think right off the tree, because they're crisp.
Yeah.
Well, they have to ripen. They have to look a little bruised, right, to be sweet. But to describe this, imagine a pineapple meets up with an apricot. It has a crispness to the flesh and a slight tart acid and then this gorgeous sweetness. I got so hooked on them, I had a bag of them in the car, and I was peeling off that skin that just slips right off as I'm driving on an autostrada in Italy, you know, where no one drives under 100 miles an hour. And I'm trying to eat, you know, and peel them with one hand as because I couldn't stop. And finally, I did because I was going to get creamed. But now you have a ton of them, right?
Yes.
Where do you live that you're so lucky?
San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, what a great town. Oh, Lord. Okay. I think, you want to know what to do with these babies so you have them for a long time and you don't just have to, all right, because three trees, you're not going to eat up everything.
Well, the birds will get to them before I do it.
Oh, don't, look, I like birds, but, you know, this is like giving jam to pigs, you know, don't do this. A couple of things. First of all, I think, I love them raw. I mean, as you know, they're delicious raw. But I think one of the great ways to store them is to freeze them.
Okay, that's what I was wondering, too.
Yeah, and I learned a trick a long time ago. There's a great book called Uncommon Fruits and Vegetables by Elizabeth Snyder Kolchi. It's one of the great classics. I mean, this is a book I've gone back to for years. And one of the things she says is you can freeze them raw, but that they really taste better if you lightly poach them in a little bit of sugar syrup. So slip off the skins.
Okay.
Just split them and get rid of that dark, shiny pit.
Okay.
And then drop them in a light, you know, like a light sugar syrup would be 2 cups of water to about a half a cup of, or a cup of sugar. And you could put some lemon zest in there if you wanted. And just cook them for about 3 or 4 minutes. You don't want to go too far. But evidently that helps keep their flavor true.
Okay.
And then you can freeze them. And, you know, one of the things I've done with them is fresh or poached, I have pureed them and frozen them and then just partially defrosted them and put them in the food processor and served them like a Slurpee, you know, with a little cream in a wine glass. Unbelievable. But you could have them in that freezer for 8 months and you would, you know, you would still have this available.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you have too many of them and you feel like shipping them, we're available.
We'll call you about them.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Shameless solicitation. But when you talk about three trees of loquats, now there's something interesting about a loquat. One of the things, by the way, in Italian, it's Nespole. This is one of those fruits that if it looks unbruised and perfect and they're oval, they're about the size of a kiwi, you know, or a big plum, and they're bright yellow orange. But without bruises, they're still underripe. They have to have, you know, a little bit of scarring. It's rather like what I think makes a great woman. You know, she has to look as though she's had some maturity, not scarred, obviously. Enough of that. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Marilyn on the line. So, Marilyn, what's on your mind?
Hi. I heard the discussion about how to preserve lemons.
Right.
And, well, now I have my lemons preserving, and I want to know some tips on how to use them.
So you really trusted me, didn't you?
Yeah.
You just went out and did it, and then you'll figure out what to do with it later.
Right. Well, because it takes some time for them to be ready to use.
That's right.
So I thought maybe you could help me, give me some good ideas of what to do with them.
Okay. You know what? I think we ought to catch up the listeners at what we're talking about. So now this is a technique that's used in Morocco and other parts of North Africa to preserve lemons. And it's a matter of really, you made little slashes in the rind, right?
Yes.
And then what did you do?
I filled the jar with lemon juice.
Right.
And I use lots of salt.
Right. A ton of salt.
A ton of salt. And I have them in a jar, one of those mason jars with the suction lid.
Right.
And they're just sitting there smiling at me.
Right. And in about 4 weeks or whatever, they're going to be in great shape. Now, this is obviously, you know, one of those very old methods of preserving something that can go bad. Now, one of the great ways that they're used in Morocco is if you're roasting chicken.
Yeah.
You take a whole lemon, you cut it in half,
right?
And then what you do is you scoop out the pulp.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And
I wondered about that.
Yeah, you don't usually use the pulp,
okay,
but the skin, which is now permeated with that salt and has that tartness to begin with, you just cut it into slices and you tuck it here and there with the roasting chicken.
Oh, I see. So while it's
Exactly. One of the other things that's done with this is that you'll make a salad of, for instance, sliced orange sections with a bit of red onion and black olives, which
I like this.
Oh, this is dynamite. And this has different mutations all over North Africa and the Mediterranean, really. You'll use, let's say for argument's sake, you use four oranges. You'll use half of a red onion that you thinly slice, a handful of black olives, and then you take half of a preserved lemon. And you cut out that pulp, you take half of it, and you slice that rind paper thin. And you gently mix that all together with black pepper and a teeny bit of vinegar and then olive oil.
Wow.
It is a killer salad, and serve that, you know, with grilled meats or fish, or serve it as a first course. It is so good. It is so good.
Oh, that sounds so yummy.
Yeah, think of it as pungent salt sour tart flavor. It's great with lamb. It's excellent with full-flavored fish. And just don't overdo it. Better to start out with a little, and then you can use more.
Okay, I'm going to try that salad.
All right, try it. It's going to be, it will be dynamite. You will love this.
I do. I love it.
I love the fact you just said, I'm going to do it, and you did it. You know? I wish more people had that sense of adventure.
Well, hey, thank you so much. I'll get back to you and let you know how
okay.
this works out.
I love these interim reports.
All right.
Go for it.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us, and we will talk if you dial up 800-537-5252. We've got Todd calling. So, Todd, what's up?
Oh, yes, something you brought to mind from a show about a month ago. I had two questions. One question is, when I was in France, there was a wine that was called Grison Gris, G-R-I-S, and then E-N and G-R-I-S. Just wanted to know if that was similar to something like kind of like a Zinfandel or something like that.
Where did you drink it?
It was in the region of Montpellier, which is the Languedoc region, near the Mediterranean.
Oh, I'm not familiar with the wine, or if I am, it happened in another life.
Okay.
It was a red, I gather.
Well, actually, it's kind of a cross between a red and a white, but it wasn't like a Zinfandel. It still tasted very much like a red wine.
Well, it was one of the great rosés.
Was that it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. They're a great, you know, rosé has been really bastardized and looked down upon, and there are great rosés, and you will find many of them in the south of France, the southwestern part of France, and these are not toy wines. They are brilliant wines. Usually a rosé is made with a red grape that they leave the skins in the wine as it starts to ferment for a short time, because the skin is what gives the color.
Gotcha.
So if you pull the skins right away, you get a white wine from a red grape. If you leave them in for a short time, you get rosé.
Oh.
If you leave them in longer, you get red.
I didn't realize it had such a, much of a nicer flavor. It wasn't super sweet like a Zinfandel, and I normally stay away from anything like that, but I really like that, and have had a hard time finding here in the States.
It may be one of those wines you're going to have to check out a bit. I'd go up on the net and see what you could find. Yeah.
Sure.
What was the second question?
Well, the second question is still another France question. When I was visiting a friend in Provence in a small town called Sisteron,
mm-hmm.
We went to his landlord's family farm where her brother still lived and had been in the family for 500 years, and it was up in the mountains. Well, anyway, we got up there, and it was quite an interesting ride, and a deux-chevaux, you know, the ones with the peel-off roof.
Yes, the little cars that are roller skates with steering wheels.
Exactly.
Yes.
In
yes.
fact, there were four of us in there, and we had to, at some points on these hills, three of us had to get out to push it because it didn't have enough horsepower.
I love it. I love it.
It's fantastic. I mean, I just laughed, but I knew that this is a great experience.
This is great.
Yeah, but eventually we got up there into the mountains, and it was just a cute little house that had been in their family for hundreds of years. And their French was so thick, I could barely understand it, but we had a great meal. And the thing that he did there, which I adore from France, is pastis. He made his own homemade pastis. And I would love to know how to make it, because what I'm buying in the States isn't comparable to what's in France. Apparently, people have said they modify the flavor to make it better for Americans.
All right,
no,
now
I disagree.
Wait. You better tell everybody what you're talking about when you say pastis.
Okay, pastis is basically an anise liqueur that tastes like licorice. And it comes in these short little glasses. They fill it up just a little bit over ice, and then you pour water in it, and it becomes very cloudy.
That's right, and it's that beautiful greenish yellow.
Yes, it's fantastic.
Right, and I don't know how to make it.
Oh.
Yeah, well, you know, they don't let me brew much.
What with those early experiments when things blew up, they haven't let me near alcohol for a long time. I'm just trying to think, though, now, I would bet you, if you did a little bit of hunting, there would be some books on how to make your own liqueurs.
Okay.
But one of the keys to this may be getting your hands on the really great anise. And it may be the seed, it may be the plant as well. I'm not sure. I'm just speculating out loud here. But I would check out, you know, the first place I'd go is Grossman's book on, I think it's alcohol and, you know, liquor and wine. Some very basic information. And then after that, I would check out sources for making your own liqueurs and people who seem to have a strong French background.
Gotcha.
It shouldn't be super difficult, but, you know, one of the things about when you taste something in the situation you tasted it, you may not be able to duplicate it exactly.
Well, I don't think that I would, but I was just hoping to get something more French-like, unlike the Americanized version of what they're serving here.
One of the great brands that, if I remember correctly, is Ricard.
Yes.
And has that disappointed you?
No, actually, that's very good. And occasionally, if I know someone's going to France, I ask them to bring me back a bottle.
Right.
Because it is good. And also, there's one called 51 that I really like as well.
Okay.
I don't know if that's by Ricard or Pernod.
Yeah, and it's Pernod, but it's the same. It's very, very similar.
Right.
So I would say, you know, I wish I could give you more specific information.
Well, that's okay. I'll check out this Grossman's book, and that'll be...
Well, it's going to be very basic, but it's going to give you a start. And then I'd go up on the web, and I would start hunting.
Very good. I'll try
and
that.
By the way, a good search engine is Google, Google.
That's so funny you say that, because a friend of mine just showed me that this past week, saying, you've got to check this one out. It's so much better than the other ones.
Yeah, it's really good for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, it really doesn't work well.
Okay, Todd,
well,
hey, sounds like a great trip to France, and I wish you luck.
All right, same to you. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with my favorite T-shirt quote. Control is an illusion. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the kitchenware area at Target, where you'll find the Bialetti Vogue cookware line from Italy, featuring Teflon platinum interiors, polished aluminum bottoms, and stainless steel handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music was composed by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.